Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Victoria Brayton. I work in the research unit of the Brussels headquarters of International Crisis Group. So I would also like to thank the conference organisers for inviting me to what promises to be a wide-ranging debate. I think we can see from today's agenda and the discussion thus far is the central position that climate change now occupies at the heart of EU policy and strategic thinking. As the joint report indicates, we've begun to engage with a breadth of potential impacts, encompassing diminishing resources, mass migration, severe socioeconomic stress, and increased political instability in some of the world's most fragile states. And I think now there's recognition that these trends demand a concerted and international response. So while I hope to contribute to today's debate, I admit to coming at it from quite a specific perspective. Crisis Group's mission and mandate is to provide country-focused and field-based analysis of specific conflict situations, and we also work to identify and recommend concrete policies to assist in their resolution. So what I hope to do today is describe how we, as a conflict resolution organisation, have traced and interpreted the climate change debate as it relates to deadly conflict. And I know this is an important point at which to take stock, a year on from the IPCC's fourth major report and the wealth of publications, events and statements that followed. And we've also seen the emergence of an increasingly nuanced debate on the relationship between climate change and conflict. So I will offer some tentative conclusions on what those debates might mean for the business of conflict analysis generally. Finally, I'll hope to focus briefly on a region identified by some as the world's first climate change conflict, that is Darfur in Sudan. Not only is Darfur one of the most serious human tragedies facing the world today, the history of the conflict there provides a useful framework for considering the import of climate change and environmental degradation more generally in relation to violent conflict. So climate change research has developed rapidly over the last decade, with findings resting on a more robust and comprehensive set of data than ever before. The IPCC's 2007 report reflected vital advances in our understanding of global warming, and it presented us with some strong evidence. We know now that global warming is increasing at a rapid rate and likely to continue, even in the event that greenhouse gases are stabilised in the short term. There have already been changes to precipitation levels, increased droughts, and we now face a greater than 90% chance of more extreme weather events in the future. So what the IPCC's finding tell us at base is the historic magnitude of current environmental change, as well as the urgency of efforts to mitigate it and to help societies adapt. But to the extent that we want to take these changes and these findings one step further, to project how changes will unfold in a particular region and then interact with other considerations to produce deadly conflict, there are some limitations to consider. Firstly, there are critical data gaps, particularly in areas of conflict, that make it difficult to know what changes have already occurred and to map future ones. Then there are the feedback effects of global warming, the consequences of melting ice caps, of changes in cloud cover, which may intensify or mitigate current processes. Projections also become more difficult at the state and sub-state level, as opposed to the broad regional level, where more localized environmental factors become relevant. Think of a country as large as Kazakhstan, for example, where environmental conditions vary considerably, with pollution levels, past radiation exposure, and farming practices continually altering water access and supply. So these limitations to regional and future modeling have at times led to conflicting projections. A 2005 paper prepared ahead of a workshop on climate change and human security used a climate model to predict rainfall patterns in sub-Saharan Africa between 2006 and 2059, and their aim was to assess how negative rainfall changes might trigger conflict. But their model showed that overall rainfall was set to increase during that period and variability to remain stable. So while a relationship had been found using past data, that relationship had little meaning for the next 50 years or so if rainfall was expected to improve. So the authors concluded, albeit tentatively, that the cataclysmic predictions linking climate change and human security may not apply to sub-Saharan Africa. Or they might. We don't quite yet know. Unfortunately, more work, as we've seen, is being done to make climate projections more specific and enhance our understandings of how and when changes may occur. But as scientific research advances, there is another gap to fill in the conflict climate equation. To the extent that we'd need to do our best to prevent wars breaking out or existing ones reigniting, we need to know how environmental change will affect human activities and societies, and in turn, how that may affect the incidence of conflict. So as we have already heard today, research tells us that many societies have already been affected by climate change, some severely. The IPCC's predictions for the future show that many areas of the world, particularly the developing world, will suffer possibly severe shortages. Experts predict that certain societies will see significant drops in food production, shifts in rainfall pattern accelerating desertification, or sea level rise inundating farmlands and furthering the spread of disease. But to assess how these scarcities of food, health, water cause or contribute to violent conflict, we need to look at two questions. Firstly, which societies will experience these socioeconomic effects? And secondly, what factors determine whether conflict will commence or persist? Observers have overwhelmingly emphasized the issue of vulnerability, the extent to which societies are dependent on climate-sensitive activities, resources, and their capacity to adapt to climate's impacts. Nicholas Stern's report on the economics of climate change foreshadowed some of the IPCC's findings. He argued that developing countries are particularly vulnerable due to their dependence on agriculture, their topological geography, their high population growth, weak infrastructure, and lack of resources, altogether leading to low adaptive capacities. He goes on to discuss a broad range of effects that these societies may experience, including an increased risk of violent conflict. Which brings us to the second question. To pull together some of the most cited scenarios, climate change could contribute in three broad and overlapping ways. Climate-induced scarcity can cause people to move in mass numbers, as we have already heard, what we now know as environmental refugees, potentially further destabilizing neighboring areas. The same declining access to water, land, or the returns on the use of land can produce further competition over resources and in turn increase the likelihood of violent conflict. Increased climate variability in the form of flooding, droughts, and other risks can cause severe economic shocks, reducing employment opportunities and increasing recruitment to armed groups, in turn increasing the capacity of those groups to wage war. But it is important to remember that these factors will inevitably interact with others, such as poor governance, political instability, ethnic tension, making it difficult to judge how climate change will affect a particular situation. Equally of interest to us as a conflict resolution organisation is the growing body of evidence showing quite the opposite relationship between climate change and conflict, and water is an excellent example. Water scarcity in the past has led to cooperation between states, certainly not always, but it has. Interstate dialogue prompted by diminishing water supplies can build trust and ultimately institutionalise cooperation on a broader range of issues. Think of India and Pakistan, for example. Water access has served as an important feature of conflict resolution negotiations. One of the six committees established to reduce tensions in 2004 was explicitly devoted to water management. So what we are reminded of, then, is the crucial challenge of trying to capture the full range of factors that drive today's most violent and intractable conflicts, and to identify those factors that can be altered to reduce tensions. The key question for us, and I expect all of us here. Oh, okay.
You need it.
1 minute. Okay, well, I better leave out Darfur. The key question then is how we translate these issues into actionable policy. And we've already seen some of the policies that have been pulled out to address and to improve adaptive capacity of certain societies. And an interesting point from our perspective, to rush very quickly, is that some of these propositions track quite closely conflict prevention efforts we've all been working to improve in recent decades: good governance, early warning, resource management. And the critical issue for us always is going to be tailoring those pressures to their specific manifestations in individual conflict situations. I think that's probably my time up, so I'll leave it there. Thank you.